Hey everyone, it's the Lady J, and you're listening to my podcast, I Never Told You What I Do for a Living. If you listened to last week's podcast, you know that I did a recap of all the episodes and interviews we've done so far. And one of the things that I took away from that recap is that I really want to talk to people who are doing something different with their career, who are in a point of flux or are questioning what they want to do next. So the next interview you're going to hear is with my friend Stella Cheeks. Stella has definitely had one hell of a year, and she's come to a lot of realizations, and she discusses all of that on this week's podcast. So instead of identifying Stella by the career that she's currently following, I sort of decided to sum up who she kind of is as a person, and I hope she doesn't mind that I picked a word for her. But I hope you really enjoy this one. It's a lot of fun. It's really funny. Stella is hilarious. If you don't listen to her podcast, the Not Your Demo podcast, which is a really awesome wrestling podcast she does with our other friend Aaron, you should check it out. But in the meantime, this is episode 8 with Stella, the doer.
Hello, Jay.
How are you? Other than the obvious, we just went through, your cat just passed away, so you're terrible, and I'm so sorry for even asking that a second time.
It's okay.
It's not getting off to a good start. How are you aside from that, I guess?
Dreadfully busy and tired, but pretty okay, I guess.
Okay, dreadfully busy is good. We're definitely going to talk about that. But I'm going to start with my usual first question, because it's basically my favorite thing to ask people, which is, what is your earliest memory of what you wanted to be when you grew up?
I used to really want to be like an actor. Not like an actor. I wanted to be an actor. I wanted to be a performer, some kind of performer. I used to I'm an only child, which I feel like is very important. I used to put on little plays for my family. I would stand on the fireplace and just perform my little heart out. There's pictures of me as like a three-year-old covered in like boas and like sunglasses, like strutting around. My earliest memory is wanting to be an actor or a witch. But, you know, I feel like those are the same.
Yeah, I mean, you could want to perform to be a witch, right? Yeah. Macbeth exists, so.
I was unnaturally into like Hocus Pocus. That movie came out when I was 4, and I watched it so much that I broke our VHS version of it. So I was like, yeah, I'm definitely going to be a witch when I grow up.
Did you go to college?
I did. I have several degrees, actually. I have an associate's degree in performance art from Lansing Community College, which I got while I was going to high school. So I would wake up, go to high school for the whole day, and then I would take a break, and then for like dinner, I guess, and then I would go to night classes and take performance classes. So by the time I graduated high school, I only had like half of a year left to finish my associate's degree. So I stayed in Lansing to do that. And then I transferred after I got my associate's degree to Chicago. I went to Loyola University Chicago to get a double major in theater performance and women and gender studies. So very marketable. I did have a poli sci minor, but I dropped that pretty quick. and then now I'm in a grad program right now. I'm going to school at DePaul for digital communication and media arts. So I'm a bit of a university whore, I guess.
Okay, so I'm going to backtrack for a second. What made you decide to do the associate's degree while you were in high school? Because like when I was in high school, I didn't even know that something like that was an option. Like, how did you find out about it and then decide that that was something you wanted to do?
So I had been doing performance since I was, my first play ever was when I was like 9 years old. It was a church play, hilariously. It was called Jonah, but like with an exclamation point. It's about Jonah and the whale. and then ever since then, I really just auditioned for and performed in anything I could. Lansing has like a pretty good community theater scene. And then obviously high school and drama club and whatever. And so I did all of that. And then I took some, if I'm remembering correctly, I took some acting class. I think it was a musical theater class, which I know you're probably rolling your eyes because I shit on musical theater all the time. But I took some class from a woman named Connie Osterley, and she was like, "You're very good. You should come to take classes at LCC. And I was like, "Well, I'm in high school. I'm like 15. And she was like, "It doesn't actually matter. You can just take night classes and be a part of the performance like track." And so I did. I never thought I would finish my associate's degree. I was just like, "Oh, I want to act more." And every semester it was like a movement based semester or Shakespeare semester or, you know, intro semester. And every semester you did your final was a big play. So you were actually put on a play. And so I just got to be in extra plays. And then when I graduated high school, I was like, "Oh, well, I'm almost done with this degree. I might as well take the math class and the English class that I need to get this degree."
So then after you got the associates, well, okay, here's another question. I'm going to kind of diverge for a second.
For sure.
If you're going to high school and going to night school, I have to assume, although knowing you as I do, I feel like this is a loaded question. Were you working at the same time?
I wasn't actually. Okay. So my grandparents were really, really supportive. They are supportive. And they liked that I was still getting like straight A's in high school. So like nothing that I was doing was affecting my academic performance. And I was doing theater at high school and I was on the lacrosse team and I wanted to do these night classes. And the deal was, as long as your grades don't slip, we'll let you take these night classes and you won't have to get a job until after high school. So once I graduated from high school, I got a job and went to LCC. But yeah, I was lucky enough. And because I got a certain GPA in Michigan, they pay for you to get an associate's degree. So I think it was paid for, or at least partially paid for, because I excelled in high school. So it was kind of like a wibbly way to like go to college and high school at the same time. But I was very supported and very lucky that I didn't have to work. But when I did work, my first job was at Panera Bread in the Lansing Mall.
That's pretty awesome. I mean, one of my first jobs was to run the, it's funny because when I did this conversation with Courtney, she talked about working at Borders and I worked in the cafe at Borders as one of my first jobs. So
yeah, I got a lot of free pastries. I gained a lot of weight when I worked at Panera. And honestly, when I moved to Chicago, everybody talks about like, "Oh, freshman 15, when you go to college." When I moved to Chicago, I like lost 15 pounds right away because I was like walking. In Michigan, you don't really like walk anywhere. Yeah. And so I was working at Panera and then eating a bunch of bread and not walking. And then I moved to Chicago and was like, "Oh, my body moves." How weird.
So how did you decide on Loyola?
It wasn't a very scientific process. I essentially knew I wanted to get out of Michigan. So I applied to zero schools in Michigan. Mm-hmm. I grew up next to Michigan State and I was like, "Fucking absolutely not." Absolutely not doing that. So I applied. I didn't really do a lot of research. I like kind of just was like picked cities. So I applied to DePaul and Loyola and University of Chicago and Boston College and I think American University in DC. And I got waitlisted at Boston, I think. And then I got in everywhere else. But Loyola was the first one to contact me, and they contacted me via text message, which I thought was very hilarious. And I was like, "Oh, cool. I like that place. I'll just go there. That's fine." That's it. I didn't really think about it. I liked their campus. It was in Chicago. They were the first ones that contacted me. And I was like, "Great. I'll just go there." I probably should have done a lot more research than I did. But I didn't. But it worked out well for me because I loved Loyola. I had a really, really great experience there. But it could have gone south.
And you're still in Chicago, so.
Mm-hmm. 10 years later, a whole decade, and here I am. And I'm going to DePaul, the other Catholic university. I'm not Catholic.
You're not going to do a production of Jonah! Exclamation point at DePaul?
Exclamation point. You know what? I'd like to find that script. I don't know if it was because it was for a local Baptist church. I don't know if it was like a script that you buy or if like one of the like pastors wrote it. I have no idea. All I know is I played a character named Annie because it was like a play within a play. It's like these Christian kids were on like a field trip to a museum and they were being told the like fable of Jonah, and then then we would act out the fable, and I played one of the like girls on the field trip, and I was like an asshole. I got typecast.
Okay, so we were talking about going to Loyola. You still live in Chicago 10 years later.
10 years later.
So what path did studying theater at Loyola take you on? Because obviously theater is kind of intrinsic in lots of aspects of your life now.
Yes. Although it's not traditional capital T theater anymore. It's interesting. So I also, when I was at Loyola, I did a lot of specialized training to be a classical actress. That's all I ever really wanted to be. I wanted to do, you know, Shakespeare and Shaw and Chekhov. And I was like, I'm going to be a very serious classical actress. And then I did, in my final year of school, I did a play. I did Titus Andronicus, which is a Shakespeare play with a company that was awful. Truly terrible. I got to play Lavinia, which was cool. And there were some good people in it, but the director is like this super big douche, awful. I did meet my husband, so that's nice. We were seeing different people at the time, and so we just became friends, but it was a...
Was he in the play?
Yeah, he used to be an actor too. Neither of us are traditional like theater actors anymore. We have, you know, he just quit theater and then became like a business person, and I still perform, but in like a different way. But yeah, he played one of Lavinia's like a million brothers. He was kind of like a background character in that. But yes, he played my brother. Hilarious. And then in my spring semester, so my final semester at Loyola, I stupidly agreed to do another Shakespeare production with that company because they offered me the role of Ophelia, and Hamlet is one of my favorite plays. And I'm not really an ingenue type, and so I got worried that I never would be able to play Ophelia again or be cast that way because I'm not traditionally cast as an ingenue. So I took it. And it was a mistake. I shouldn't have done it. I was going through a really bad breakup at the time, and the director kept bringing it up to, like, I don't know, help my madness or whatever. And it was miserable. It was awful. Nick was also in that play. He also played my brother because he was Laertes, which I think is funny. but that's kind of how we got closer too. We became, you know, better friends during that. Friends to friends with benefits to marriage. but yeah, I had a really truly awful experience with that play. And then as I was going through my final semester in school, I kind of realized that while I loved performing, I didn't really want to live a performance life. It's really hard and unstable, and I didn't feel very... I felt confident in my abilities, but I didn't feel confident in my ability to withstand the hustle, I guess, that it takes to be an actor. So I instead decided to try out a new avenue of performance. And that's how I first started burlesque. Because I was like, well, I still want to perform. I am a glutton for attention, but I want to do something new. And so that's how I found burlesque. So I did all of that training in theater and then was like, nope, don't want to do it. And then became like a nerdy stripper. Yeah, that's my weird path to burlesque. Because
I'm sorry, I just can't. The idea of explaining what you do as being a nerdy stripper is really hilarious to me, because I look at like pictures of you doing these things and I think to myself, like, there's a lot of work that went into this. So I feel like nerdy stripper, you're really underselling yourself there.
Well, the reason I was drawn to burlesque as like a substitute performance art is because, like I said, one of my degrees was in gender studies, and I had done a big project about like cabaret and burlesque performance. And so I was already intrigued by it. And then having gone through that really awful experience during Hamlet, I was really like, I need to do some kind of creative art that is more solo driven. Because like burlesque, you are essentially... Even when it's collaborative, you are kind of in charge of your own costume and your own concept and your own, you're like the director and performer of your own little mini play when you put on a burlesque act. That's how I think of it. I think of it as like vignettes, like tiny plays. Mm-hmm. And I needed a lot more independence in my performance, which is kind of how I found burlesque. And I say nerdy stripper because like primarily, like I do classic burlesque sometimes here and there, and I've been doing it for... God, 8-9 years now, like a long time. But I prefer to do Nerdlesque, which is like themed character stuff. But yeah, I guess it does undersell it a little bit. Burlesque is very hard, but it's also silly. So I don't try and take it too seriously, because that's the best part about it, is that it's really silly, in my opinion.
So, I mean, obviously there's a component. Well, I guess not obviously, because sometimes Shakespeare can be pretty graphic, but there is like an element to burlesque involving a certain level of nudity that makes it very different. And there's a different kind of vulnerability in something like that. Like, how did you decide that was something that you were comfortable doing, or were you not comfortable and you were like, I'm just going to fucking get over it and it'll be fine?
You know, that's something that no one's ever asked me, actually. That's so weird.
Really?
Yeah.
That would be the first thing that I would ask someone, to be like, how did you decide to take your clothes off? Because that's not a thing. I mean, personally, for me, it's not something that I am really comfortable with my body. So the idea of someone else being comfortable is just like, and how did you come to that? Because that would be great. I would love to be comfortable like that.
I don't know, actually. And I'm trying to like reverse engineer it right now in my mind. Cause like, I'm not, you know, for somebody who takes her clothes off on stage and has for a long time, I'm not like 100% comfortable with my body. I'm not like doing backflips every day. Like, overall, I'm pretty comfortable, but I have days and like moments where I'm like, ugh, you know, we all do. So I think that's a little bit of a misnomer, that everybody who does burlesque is like somehow like has this magical power where we're like, yes, we accept every inch of our body. I think that's the goal, and I think it helps, but I don't, for at least for me, that's not true 100% of the time. And there's also every once in a while you see a picture and you're like, oh, what's happening there? Though you do get used to seeing like weird naked photos of yourself and you're like, okay, well, that's what my body does in that shape with that amount of clothing on. But I think when I first started, it's so funny to me because I cannot think of a moment when I switched over from traditional theater to burlesque where I was trepidatious about the nudity part. I think for me, I was just in performance for so long that, and especially because the type of performance that I did and specialized in was classical tragedy theater, where you have to be like really painfully vulnerable, that playing Ophelia is more scary and more vulnerable to me than taking my top off in front of strangers, because it's just a body, right? Like, we all have bodies, but like doing that in doing like an Ophelia madness scene, like that is, to me, feels scarier and more vulnerable. So I think the nudity part was kind of like, oh yeah, sure. I'll dress up like C-3PO and take my clothes off. That's totally a natural transition. But yeah, I don't know. I've never, and really quickly too, in my burlesque career, I never really had weird boundaries. Like, some people are like, I have to wear full coverage underwear, or I'll only strip down to this bit, or it has to be in this way. And I was running around naked backstage. I didn't care. I still do. I don't care. It's funny that the other day, like, this is a sidebar, but obviously my cat passed away this weekend, and she was really sick on Friday, and I had to go to a show. And it's normally, if it was any other show, I obviously would have been like, hey, personal emergency, I can't come. But Friday was the show that I produce and write and perform in and essentially stage manage. And I was like, this show doesn't really run without me. I have to go. So I went and I told everybody kind of what was happening. And I was like, I'm going to have to leave as soon as the show's done. I appreciate you all understanding, you know, show must go on. We'll get it done. And as I was leaving, one of my friends came up to me and gave me like a huge hug, and she was being really sweet. And as I pulled away, I was like, oh, she's completely naked. giving me this like this genuine, like big sympathetic hug. So I feel like it's something that you would see on like an HBO show, like a comedy show, like a Fleabag moment where she looks to the camera and is like, this is a nice moment. But also my friend is fully naked, just hugging me. But yeah, I don't know. I'm so used to it now that I'm like, yeah, this is normal. You don't hug your friends naked? Oh, okay. But not in like a sexual way either. It's just like, this is how we are, just always like this. But yeah, I didn't even think twice about it. I was just like, sure, it's another character. It's another performance. It's just a different layer.
this character gets naked at the end. That's all.
Yeah. That character dies. This character gets naked at the end.
I hope you know that's definitely going to be the soundbite for this episode. So you got into burlesque after college, but you also, I don't know how long you did this job, but you recently left a position for a job you were doing for a while, right?
I've left several positions this year.
Okay. Well, I'm talking about wedding person, wedding planner, wedding yes. organizer.
Yeah. I've had this weird, I'm coming to realize this year, because I've been in like, I've had several years of like, what am I doing with my life type situations, you know, mid 20s. But I'm coming to realize that like for so long, I defined my life and my dream as I want to be an actor. I'm going to be an actor. There's nothing else. This is what I'm doing. This is where all my free time goes. This is where my school goes. This is where everything goes. This is where all my energy goes. There's nothing else. No backup plans, nothing. And then in my final semester of school, I realized, oh, I don't want to do this in the way that I thought. I need to try something new. I need to try something different. And I never realized how big of an impact that choice would have on me, like emotionally and psychologically, which sounds stupid in retrospect. But so I got my performance jollies off, I guess, by still being able to perform and do burlesque. And I still do that. And I still do love it. My love of it has evolved and gone through many iterations, but I still do it and I still love it. But I always say that burlesque for me is above a hobby and below a career. It's something I love. I do make some money on it. I am good at it, but I don't want to be that to be like the only thing I do, I guess. And so for the past decade, I've just tried to figure out what else I'm supposed to do. And so I've had tons of different jobs. And one of them is like wedding coordinating. So I, through burlesque, knew a couple photographers who were wedding photographers. And I was like, hey, I put on essentially like a mini event every month, which is like a theater performance. It's new every month. It's a different theme. I'm scheduling. I'm, you know, selling tickets, doing decor. Like I'm essentially running a mini event. I think I would be good at event planning. Do you know anybody that I could like talk to? And so they set me up with a wedding planner in Chicago, and I worked an event with them, and they really liked me. And so I was a wedding event assistant, which is basically a day of position. You like get the information, you go to the wedding, you kind of just work it, you do whatever is needed, but you're not the main wedding planner. So you just kind of show up and help run the events. And so I've done that job for, God, 5 years now. And the last wedding I'm going to work is December 28th, and then I'll be done. But in that interim, I also ran a wedding venue, and I worked for another wedding company. And I thought that like, I'm good at event planning, I should do this. And it's not that I'm not good at it, but it doesn't really bring me joy. And also, I feel like I'm the opposite of people. I feel like most people get married and they're like, that was so fun. I want to be an event planner. And I got married and I was like, oh, I never want to do this again. I planned mine. I'm very happy with it. And I never want to go to another wedding ever again. I mean, I'll go to people's weddings, but I don't want to be there. But yeah, I really tried to make that my career, because I thought logically that's what made sense considering all the things that I do in my background. But I've come to realize this year through therapy and self-reflection that I don't need to put a square peg in a round hole. Like I'm good at it, but just because I'm good at something doesn't mean that that's the thing I should be doing. And so I decided to stop pursuing that as a career option. And also the woman that I work with is moving to Holland. And I was like, oh, this seems like a natural end for everyone.
You go to Holland and I'll take my clothes off at the end. And this will be how this
works. Exactly.
So what other ways did you try to figure out what you want to do? Because 5 years, that's only, you said it's been 10, right?
So, and that was only like that was mostly part-time. Like when I was the venue coordinator, that was full-time. And I had done other things in the wedding industry, but yeah, it was just kind of on and off. See, like with the trying so many different things, I have had multiple different jobs at once. Like God, earlier this year I had like 6 jobs, like too many jobs. The 2019 millennial hustle is a monstrosity. Other things, I was a preschool teacher for a couple years. Also wow. something that I'm very, yeah. Also something that I'm very good at. I love children. I'm really good with children. I hated being a preschool teacher. It's really hard, and you don't get paid a lot of money at all. You get paid like, I think I was making like $13 an hour to teach a class of 17 3-year-olds. Yeah. So you don't get, it's really hard and it's really rewarding, but it's, you have to love it in a way that I didn't in order to like essentially work for barely any money.
Right.
So I was a preschool teacher for a while, and then I left that to become a nanny, because the fucked up thing is you make a ton of money being a nanny. Mm-hmm. And I was really lucky. I worked for 2 families that I adored, and we're still in touch. And I got really lucky there. But the weird thing about being a nanny is like, yes, you can make a career out of it, but and you do make good money if you work for, you know, a family who's on the up and up, like my family. Like I pay taxes and stuff. Like they treated it as a real job, which I appreciated. But you're also just in somebody else's home. And even if it is a real job, sometimes it doesn't feel like a real job. It doesn't feel like fulfilling, or it didn't feel fulfilling for me. So it was just like a mind fuck. Like I love this family I'm working with. I love this child. I'm making good money, but I just feel stuck. And so I, even though it was really good money, I also pulled myself out of that arena. And I was like, no, even though you could get jobs and be perfectly fine and make good money for the rest of your life as a nanny, like obviously that's not what you want to do. So I like step away from that as well. I worked retail. Obviously, we all work retail. I was the assistant food and beverage manager at a theater because I was like, oh, I love theater. Maybe if I work adjacent to theater. Nope. Also not that. And then I do social media for a pro wrestling website, Cage Side Seats, which I like a lot, but also isn't like a full-time career type thing. So I'm in this like weird arena where I've tried so much and nothing, and even the things I like are not the thing. And so I'm in this like weird nebulous area right now where I'm like trying to cull the herd and trim the fat and be like, okay, even if you're good at this or like this, you can let it go because it served its purpose and we can put our energy somewhere else. So I don't run around being like, I have 6 jobs and I want to cry all the time. So yeah, did that answer your question? I feel like I just rambled.
Nope. That was perfect. Okay. That was excellent. It gave me, I have follow-up questions.
Many follow-ups.
So yes. One is, I mean, it's interesting because you use the phrase what I am supposed to do.
Yeah.
Do you feel like a career should be a calling?
It's really hard, right? Because I feel like there are people, and this is not a bad thing, and this is not like a dig on anybody. I feel like there are people that can get a job and it can be a good job or fine job. And they're like, I don't love it, but it's fine. And it's consistent. And I go to work and I make money and then I live my life. And I really envy that. I really envy people who can be like, yeah, it's good. I don't hate it. I don't love it. It's just what I do. And it's my, you know, it's my job. There's something in me, which is good or bad. It's nothing that I really have to be, I don't have to be happy doing what I'm doing, but I have to feel like I'm serving a purpose. I have to feel like a sense of fulfillment, I feel like, to get joy out of what I'm doing. And so I don't know if like me saying like what I'm meant to be doing, I don't know if there's like a destiny to it. I think that that's silly. But there is a level of like purpose that not all jobs have that I am seeking, I guess.
Do you feel like what you do with the podcast
is in any way speaking to that?
I used to, but it's hard because, don't get me wrong, I love podcasting. I love Erin. She's like one of my best friends. But we podcast about a thing that happens weekly that takes a lot of effort to like watch and keep up on and have an opinion on and whatever. I think that it's fun, but I don't think that it's like a career. And I don't think that that's the, I think that's just like a hobby that we like accidentally monetized. You know what I mean? Like, again, it's 2019, monetize your hobbies. So yeah, and I don't think so. Honestly, this past like year or so, again, I mentioned earlier that I'm in grad school and I originally went to grad school. I went to this program. I went to grad school to try and find purpose, to be honest. Like when I wrote my like statement of purpose, hilarious, to get into grad school, it was like, look, I have a lot of disparate skills and I am essentially going through a quarter life crisis and I need something to help me focus my abilities. And I originally chose my program because it's half academia, which is like the digital communication part, and half more hard skills like graphic design and audio editing and whatever. So originally I was like, oh, I'll go and I'll learn how to do more audio stuff and this and that. And then I took a couple audio classes there and I didn't particularly like them, mostly because I think the teacher is a tool, but that's a story for a different time. But I really fell in love with the academia part in a way that I didn't anticipate. I love my digital communication classes and I love communication. It's funny when I used to hear people be like, oh, I'm a communication major. I'd be like, that's a fake thing. What do you mean? What do you mean you're a communication major? Aren't we all?
No. Some of us are definitely not. I can vouch.
Yes, that's fair. That's fair. Some of us should major in communication. But I found myself really drawn to the academia stuff in a way that I hadn't been before. And actually, last quarter, I did a teaching assistant job at DePaul where I co-taught a class of undergrads. And it was like a moment where I was like, oh, everything clicks right now. I like this a lot. And it was the hardest thing that I've ever done. And I was miserable, but I was like really happy being miserable, if that makes sense. Because it was really hard and I was challenging myself and it was new and like 30 undergrads and some of them are, you know what undergrads are like. I'm sure you were once an undergrad.
Yes, we've all been 19 and stupid. Yes.
Yeah. But I really, really like that. And I find I'm getting a lot of support from my like professors and things. But then there's this like little, you know, we all have that little insecurity voice. And part of me is like, it's too late. Everything's too late. You're 30. Your life is over, which is not true. Obviously, 30 is not old, but it does feel old to me sometimes to be starting a new career or like potentially a new career. So that's kind of where I am, where I've like tried so many things. And now I think I finally found the thing that I like, but I feel like this scared trepidation of like, ah, what if it's too late? Or what if I put all my energy into this thing and it turns out like all the other things?
Well, I mean, these are all really like part of the reason why I wanted to have this conversation is because I had a feeling that this would be the thing that you wanted to talk about, because I think like it's very nice when people are like, and then I found my calling when I was 16 and, you know, or like I have a friend who lives in Chicago and I hope to get her on this podcast one day. But basically, like she wanted to be a civil engineer when she was 9. She actually like managed to say those words, I want to be a civil engineer, to my own mother, who was completely stunned and had to go to an encyclopedia and look up what a civil engineer was. She builds bridges for a living. That's what she does. She went to MIT, you know, she graduated with honors and she went to grad school and now she does bridge design and architecture and all that kind of stuff for a living and walked a very straight path. She is in the fucking minority. Like, most people I know don't walk paths like that anymore because industry fluctuates so violently.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, the job that I have now did not exist when I was in college. I could not have majored in my current profession. What you're going to school for now also wasn't a thing when I was going to undergrad, because like social media wasn't a thing. None of that existed. So, you know, someone working in like marketing for social media, that's not a thing you could have majored in 10 years ago because it didn't exist. So it makes sense that there's so much fluctuation in the jobs that people have. But I think also this like idea of lifelong careers and stuff, like my dad was just telling me the other day that someone at the job that he is now retired from is retiring with 25 plus years with the company. And I just thought to myself, who the fuck is going to be able to say when we're in our late 60s that they worked 25 plus years for the same organization? Organizations don't even last that long anymore.
Like,
right? So I think, I mean, all of this is really, really important because I truly don't believe you're alone. I think you are very, very much in the majority of how people feel right now.
Absolutely. And part of me knows that because I talk to other people and I have friends who, especially like people who are, and not saying that this only happens, but like a lot of my friends are like artsy fartsy because I did go to theater school and I am, you know, in burlesque and stuff. And I feel like I see that especially with people who are like artistic, like they have this thing that they're very passionate about, but they also are trying to make a living and they're also trying new things. And like, and yeah, it's funny because like you meet those people who are those like rare people who knew what they wanted to do and then they went to school and then they got it. And like, I'm so happy for them, but part of me just wants to like punch him in the face and be like, oh, that's the worst. I'm so jealous of you. But yeah, it's so, and it's funny because like there's that, the whole thing too about like, you know, baby boomers being like, well, when I was your age, like millennials don't know anything because like you just got to get a job and then you buy a house and you're like, no. That's like a fucking impossibility now, bro. Like, that's not what this is. You're told to go to college and then you don't really think about why you're going to college. And then you get out of college and you're like, what now? I guess I'll work at Starbucks, which is fine. Starbucks is an absolutely like valuable job. And like some people make careers out of that. But like most people don't go to college to do a retail job or to, you know, be a social media manager. I mean, people do now, but like complicated, whatever. It's you walk out of school and I feel like school, you feel less prepared than when you walked in the door.
So one of the things, this is actually very amazingly timed. So this morning I was looking on LinkedIn and I saw an article from, I think it was from the Washington Post, about English majors have dropped drastically. Like it's like 25% less English majors across the board in the United States than I think it was like 10 years ago or something like that. Drastic decrease in the number of English majors, whereas things like coding, people in like STEM majors and in healthcare have increased dramatically in the other direction. So one of the things that the article was talking about, though, because it was written by an economist, is that we need more people who have soft skills, because people graduate from these programs and have absolutely no soft skills. They don't know how to write eloquently and they don't know how to tell a story. And if you can't take your data and turn it into some kind of story that anyone, you know, whether it's like your C-suite or your, you know, like the just the general people who work for your company or the people who might be buying shares in your company, like those things are really, really fucking important. And people don't have those skills and people don't have a lot of communication skills. So that's why, like, I've learned at 32 not to be ashamed of having a degree in theater, because the things that I learned in a theater arts program are incredibly valuable. And I have skills that most of my peers actually don't have at this point.
Absolutely. I'm starting to realize that too. And it's funny because something like coding or, you know, digital media production, it is all about storytelling. It's so incredible to me that that is like left out. Cause like when you think about an ad campaign, a digital ad campaign, that is about storytelling. That is about communication. That's part of the reason why I love my program and why I'm really drawn to this digital communication field, is because it kind of combines like the stuff that I've done with the podcast and social media. And like, I mean, how we met on the internet, you know what I mean? And there's this like beautiful, like the internet is a terrible trash place, but it's also like beautiful and interesting. And it is about stories, whether they be terrible stories or beautiful moments of connection. And the fact that our university system on the whole exists in such like a, you are an English major, you are this, you are that. And instead of having more like well-rounded education, like it is remarkable to me. And I know that there are some like liberal arts colleges, like ones I went to, that claim to give you like a well-rounded thing, but that's just saying like, oh, well, as a theater major, you also have to take a math class. And it's like, how is that well-rounded? It's just making me take a math class.
Yeah.
I think in the next like several years, we'll see trade schools really tick up and university attendance really tick down.
I 100% agree with that, if for no other reason than because nobody can fucking afford it anymore.
Well, there's that too. There's the whole like, you know, some people don't even have access to it. And then the people that do have access to it are like, well, I'm super in debt for my English degree, which has a lot of value, but also you can't get a return on that investment. Like, it has a lot of value in culture and society and the way that people communicate. But if you can't turn that into a career or into a way to make money to live, then like, fuck, it doesn't have value.
So you mentioned something before, and I feel like this ties into that, about like the millennial side hustle, right? I cannot for the life of me pinpoint when this became a thing, but your ability to market yourself and hustle for whatever it is that you're after is so, it's like the number one most valuable skill. I don't know that I have it. I wish I had more of it, if I have any of it at all. But like, you've got fucking droves of it. Like, maybe you need less of it, because I feel like you end up with so much stuff. Not that you're not deserving of all the things that have come to you, but like, you hustle so fucking hard that sometimes I just want to be, can someone slip Stella a sleeping pill so that she just gets some rest? Because I'm worried about how hard she's working all the time. Like, do you feel like that was a thing that was just intrinsically in you, or this was like a thing that you kind of saw evolving over time, that you were like, I can do this. I can just work my fucking ass off and it'll be great and I'll sleep when I'm dead? Or what? Like, how did you kind of embrace some of that?
Two answers. One, I always joke that my house, like my Game of Thrones house motto, is it gets done because it has to.
Fair.
Okay. I have a really hard time saying no to things. That's also a thing that I'm learning, because I guess there's some kind of fear, like a FOMO of like missing out on an opportunity. And I am naturally very curious. I like trying new things. I like talking to new people. I like interacting and like creating things. Mm-hmm. But also, like, you have to know that part of that is a facade, right? I'm the busiest, laziest person you'll ever meet. I know that sounds crazy to say that I'm lazy, but like, I truly am. And it takes a lot of effort sometimes for me to do all the things I do. And sometimes I'm like, wow, I don't know how this all came together. I guess it gets done because it has to. I don't know. I feel like maybe just in the moment I seize on opportunities because they seem, honestly, I do a lot of things I do is because I think they seem fun. And then I try and turn them into things that can be of benefit to me or to the people that are doing them with me. I feel like I have a little bit of a natural business acumen that maybe is just something that I have because I watch like my grandfather do it and my husband is really good at stuff like this. And so I have that constant support. And then also I think it's just like a natural thing. I've always been, I mean, you heard me earlier. I went to high school and then I went to lacrosse practice and then I went to college in one day. Like, I don't know if it comes from being an only child that I just feel like I need to be busy and surround myself with people and have that interaction. But I don't know. I've just always filled my time with stuff, and I'm trying as like a 30-year-old to fill my time more. It's not that I want to be doing less. It's that I want to be, what is the word? It's not necessarily less. It's just I want to be more focused in the things that I'm doing. So instead of doing six things okay, I'd like to be doing three things really well. And like I'm trying to learn how to still – I'm trying to learn to not overcommit to things that maybe I'm not that interested into and to recommit and focus on the things that do actually mean a lot to me. And that's been kind of my growth this year, which is why I've said goodbye to several different like jobs or hobbies, and I'm trying to really refocus onto the things that matter. So I don't know. I don't know if that answered your question. I'm a freak.
I mean, yeah, we're all a little weird in our own way. That's fine. I feel like the only child thing really, really speaks to me because I've always kind of been that way myself.
Yeah.
I just suspect because I was very busy as a kid, not in like a, you know, your parents say you have to do sports and stuff, but like I wanted to do everything. I wanted to be, you know, in drama club and take drama classes at some like, you know, local theater or whatever. And I wanted to take dance classes and I wanted to do this and that. And because my mom didn't work, I had the ability to do that, right? Like I wasn't beholden to an adult schedule because she could take me here or there or whatever. And then when I got older, I just didn't know how to stop because it also meant that like when I went home, I was by myself again, and that's boring. And like that becomes very seductive in its own right.
Yeah.
Like the just completely do nothing thing. And I know how bad that can be. So it's kind of like this weird figuring out a counterbalance between being like maybe like depressed because you're not doing anything and you're by yourself, or being like so overworked or overcommitted that you're like you've basically like flung yourself headfirst into anxiety. And it's just like there must be some kind of good balance between those two things.
Yeah, you're really speaking to the choir there, because I feel like I oscillate between very busy all the time, go, 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 go. And I'm going to sit alone in this dark room for 8 hours and binge watch TV and no one can talk to me. And in finding that balance is really hard. And like when I say I am going to find people and communicate because I'm an only child, it's not that I have a problem being by myself. I love being by myself. I'm like an egomaniac. I rather like myself, which is good. Like, you know, we all have our problems. I still go to therapy and everything, but like, it's not like I'm running away from myself. But I do try and find things to surround myself with other people, because I did. I grew up, you know, by myself most of the time. And my parents were very young when they had me. And that doesn't mean that they were bad parents or anything. And I had my grandparents who were like a second set of parents. But I got, because they were so young, I feel like I got a crazy amount of freedom. And just like you said, your mom was around to kind of like take you wherever you wanted to go. My parents didn't know how to say no to me. So they were like, sure, you can do this new hobby or try this new thing or, you know, do whatever. And so I kind of got the freedom to kind of fill my time and do whatever I wanted and try the violin and take theater classes and, you know, play lacrosse and go to college at night while being in high school. And, you know, sometimes I wish my parents were a little more strict in a like, no, if you're going to play violin, you're going to stick with it and you're going to show some like discipline, instead of being like, oh, you're done with that? You want to move on to something else? Okay. I feel like that maybe would have helped me a little bit more in life. I feel like focus is like a elusive word that I don't like. I know what it means, but I don't know what it feels like.
Do you feel like you're the kind of person who can go after something if it's what you really want? Or have you ever felt like you weren't in a position to ask for something or put yourself out there for an opportunity?
I feel like if I know what I want, I feel very comfortable going for it. But the knowing what you want part is the elusive part, right? People say like, follow your dreams, follow your passion, like put everything you have into what you want to do. But they're missing the first step, which is what do you want to do, right? Mm-hmm. And that is the thing that is the hardest part, because I know myself and I know that when I do want something, I will go for it 100% and try it with all of my, like, you know, being. But it's that first step of what do you want, which is the hardest part for me, at least. Like, what do you actually want? What is your goal? What is your long-term goal? And I think part of, you know, like I mentioned earlier, for a long time, my goal was this really one-sided thing. It was, you're going to be an actor, you're going to be in theater. That's it. Done. And then when it suddenly wasn't, I tried to fill that void with so many different things that I kind of gave myself a head rush and spin it around. And only now, almost like a, you know, decade later, I'm starting to like refocus and have these harder conversations with myself and be like, no, what do you really want? Not what should you try? What will you be good at? What is an opportunity that somebody's given to you? So you said yes at, cause you're like, well, maybe this is the thing. But really having harder conversations, like what should you put your energy into, which is a harder question than will you put all of your energy into it?
I think you also just kind of pinpointed something that we haven't really talked about in any of the other conversations I've had with people so far, which is that sometimes the thing that you want isn't actually a thing that you're good at.
Yeah.
Or something that comes naturally to you. And sometimes it's easy to say like, oh, this thing comes naturally to me, so I'll just do it because I can, even if it doesn't make me happy or even if it's not, you know, necessarily fulfilling, like you talked about before. But the thing that I do want, I either don't feel like I possess the natural talent for it, or I don't have like the beginner skill set yet, and I don't know how to get it. So I'm just gonna kind of pretend like it's not the thing that I want because it just seems really complicated. I don't even know how to get started.
Yeah. Or it's too much work, or, you know, I'll have to give up this thing that I know that I'm good at, that is my safety blanket, to try that thing. Absolutely. That's 100%. That's kind of where I am right now, especially with like school and kind of figuring out, oh no, I do want this. This is the thing I want. I do want to be a professor. Like, I do want to do this, but that means I'll have to go get a PhD, which is going to be really, really hard, and might have to move my family to do that. And I'm good at this, but it's really, really hard. It doesn't come naturally to me. I have to work harder in a way that I haven't in a long time, but then when you get that reward, it is almost more fulfilling because it's not something that you're just good at, right? Like, that feels good for me to be like, I worked really hard on that thing and I'm getting, you know, a positive response, or I feel like I earned something instead of just like, oh yeah, I'm good at this. But that is like a tricky, it's like a deceptive thing. Like, oh, I'm good at this, I should just do this. But it's like, no, you should do what you want to do, even if it's harder. Hard things are sometimes the good things, not always. Sometimes your cat dies and that's really hard. Sorry. The gallows humor.
It's fine. This is a goth podcast. So it's acceptable.
I'm wearing all black right now, so.
Same. Well, this is, I mean, I can't even, is there anything left that we haven't covered? Is there a job we have not talked about?
I've never tried to be a zookeeper, which is not true because I did look into it once. I didn't do it, but I did look into it.
Have you ever considered making something wrestling related your full-time job?
I have definitely considered it before. I feel like I got the cage side job, which I love. I really love. But I like where it sits in my life. I said about burlesque, it's more than a hobby, but it's less than a career. And that's kind of where the wrestling media stuff sits for me. And I like that because I still find enjoyment from it. And I still, you know, make money from it, but it hasn't ruined it for me, if that makes sense.
Yes. Yes, that's very, yes, yep.
And as you know, it's very easy to ruin wrestling.
Yeah. I mean, you can just let wrestling ruin you. That's basically what I did. So, yeah.
That
I
is true. Get
it. Yeah. But although you're not flying back and forth 3,000 miles several times a year in order to let wrestling ruin you. So I would never suggest that to anyone or to their bank account. It wasn't something I've ever had.
Yeah. My favorite, fortunately for me, my favorite wrestling company is in Chicago like 80% of the time. So
there you go. Have you ever considered running your own wrestling company?
Absolutely not. Okay. I run a burlesque company, which is essentially a circus. And I was like, oh, I couldn't do that and have to like figure out people's safety. No way.
Yeah, no, that, yeah. Cool. I kind of think that's all the questions that I have. Would you like to give people ways to contact you? You don't have to, because I realized you just put a lot of personal shit on here, and then to turn around and be like, this is where you can tweet me all of your garbage opinions about my life. That's entirely up to you.
No, absolutely. I told you earlier, I'm an egomaniac. Please come talk to me. I'm on Twitter at Stella_Cheeks. And I'm also on Instagram at Stella Cheeks. You can contact me there. I can talk to you guys about, you know, burlesque or not figuring out your job until you're, or your career path until you're in your 30s. Or if you just want to see cute pictures of my cat. She was really cute, guys. Sorry to make you all sad.
She was really cute. She and oh, so oh, wait, cute. I have one other question. Do you make all of your own costumes?
No. So I remember earlier in this conversation when I said that I was really lazy. Mm-hmm. I absolutely am. Do I know how to use a sewing machine? Yes. Do I enjoy sewing? Absolutely not. So the way that I approach a number is usually I come up with the concept first, and then I'll find the song, and I'll kind of figure that out. And I'm really, really fortunate to be surrounded by a lot of really talented people. And I also am I really believe in the philosophy of paying people for their quality work and their art. And so I know a lot of people who are talented costumers. And so generally I'll work with them to come up with, you know, my idea. I'll usually design it or at least co-design it. And then I will pay somebody to create it because I don't like doing it. And I know that they'll do a better job anyways. And I rather give somebody money for their job and their career and then get a better product for mine.
Well, whoever did your Aziraphale outfit was dead on the money. That's a really good look.
Well, that is just like being really picky on what you buy on Amazon. I did that, but I didn't make it.
Okay, fair. That's fair. That's fair. Well, you did a great job picking things on Amazon.
Thank you. It's almost like I'm very obsessed with that show.
Who would
and book and fan fiction and fan art and everything about it. It's the best.
Okay. There is one other. I'm sorry. I keep you say things and then I want to ask you something else. So.
Oh, wait. I do want to give a shout out, though. But my pasties, those flaming sword pasties, I did pay somebody to make those because they're really good at their job and they make excellent pasties. And I knew I wanted flaming sword pasties, obviously. And I could never do that. And so I did pay somebody to make those. So, because Amazon don't have flaming sword pasties.
But Stella does, and that's what really matters.
Okay, other question, sorry.
Other question was, so when you're talking about paying people for their art, you and Aaron have a Patreon for your podcast, right?
Ah, we do. Yeah, we're on Patreon, Not Your Demo Pod. We're bad at Patreon, but mainly what we do is we do a series called Every Mania Ever, where we go back and we watch the old WrestleManias because we grew up watching wrestling, but we weren't like super fans until like 4 years ago. And so there's like a big chunks of time where we weren't watching. So we're going back and we watch them and we decide if they're good or not. Most of the time they're not.
Can't imagine why.
And then also on Patreon, it's mostly we do a series called NYD After Dark, where it's mostly just Erin telling weird sex stories because she's poly and has a lot of weird stories to tell. Though I share some occasionally. So, you know, my life's not as crazy as hers, but there's some good ones. There's some interesting people out there.
my question is more about how did you come to the decision to create a Patreon? Because I feel like this is a question, I've posed this question on Twitter all the time, like, how do people decide on which Patreons to support? And then how, as a creator, do you decide, like, okay, it's time for me to monetize this thing that I've been doing for free, and now I'm going to ask people to give me money for this thing they've been consuming for free? And just sort of wrapping my head around that is very hard. So I feel I should ask someone who's done it while I have you here.
For sure. Because it's a lot of work. You know this. It's a lot of work to create a podcast. And it's fun and, you know, all of those things. But fun things can still be work. And I personally got to a point where I was like, it is not worth it for me to do this without some kind of monetary, you know, backup. But I like Patreon as a model because people can still get the free product. The product we put out every week that does take a lot of work is still free 100%. And Patreon is a, if you want to, you can show that you like the, you know, like what we do and support what we do and throw us a couple bucks every month. And yeah, you'll get some extra things here and there, but it's mostly a way to be like, we like this thing that you're doing and we appreciate how much work you put into it. So here's some money. That old saying, time is money, is like an absolutely true thing. We live in this world, especially in this digital world, where everybody is a creator, which is awesome and amazing. But because of that, you know, people put their fan art on Tumblr because they want to share it because they're excited. But then sometimes their fan art gets stolen and other people make money from it, or people just take it and don't realize, like, oh, that took 15 hours for somebody to draw. And they're sharing that with you because they want to. And if there's a way for you to, like, buy an art print or throw $5 at a Ko-fi, like, I think if you have the money that you should, like, supporting art in any way that you consume for free, if you're able to, like, I feel like you should, because there's so many creators and a lot of them honestly are women, and women are already, like, treated monetarily very poor in our society. And if you like something, you don't go to a play for free, right? You usually pay to see that art, and that's like a weird hierarchy or whatever. But like Tumblr fan art and a free podcast that you really like is also art that you should be paying for if you have the ability to. If you don't, I get it. And if you don't, and if you listen to 17 podcasts and you're like, there's no way I could give money to all of them, I totally get it. But if there's one that you really love weekly and you have a dollar, absolutely, you know, or, you know, a Ko-fi, or tell that person how much you like it. Like, this idea that we share art for free now in this digital society is truly amazing, but it does have that really dark side where people kind of get taken advantage of monetarily. And so I think a service like Patreon is positive because you get to be a literal patron of the arts if you want to. And it's a choice, right? You don't have to. So that's my kind of soapbox from it.
I think that's great, because I'm going to ask other people about it, and I'm sure other people will have other opinions. But I definitely wanted to ask somebody who's actually using the platform.
I also support other people's Patreons, and I, like, you know, I buy a lot of fan art. I, you know, I throw money to Ko-fi here and when I can, like, because I don't know, that's something, maybe just because I come from like a performance background, but that's something that I really believe in is supporting creators that you care about, because then they keep creating things and then we have cool shit. Like, support cool shit. Vote with your money.
I mean, I think there's always a discussion going on. It doesn't matter if it's in wrestling or it's in some kind of like fan art thing or it's a gaming conversation, but there's always a conversation around like paying people for things. I actually recently listened to Amanda Palmer on Scroobius Pips podcast from like 2 years ago, I think, maybe even 3 years ago now. Where like she had just recently come under scrutiny for like putting out a call for musicians to come.
Oh, that was a while ago, I think.
Yeah. And
I'm low-key obsessed with Amanda Palmer. So,
well, she's also using Patreon, which I think is so interesting, especially considering the fact that I saw the Dresden Dolls open for Panic at the Disco like 13 years ago, I think, or something like that. Like, I mean, the first time I ever heard the Dresden Dolls, I think I was like 16 years old or something like that. So to see the like kind of trajectory of Amanda Palmer is quite something, especially because she went on to marry like the dream guy as far as like every goth girl in the world is concerned. Like, she snagged Neil Gaiman, and that's just, I mean, it makes a lot of sense, but it's also secretly unfair to me. But I think there's so much conversation around like, are you paying people? Should you pay people? Should people be taking work without pay? Like, it's such a hot topic, I guess. And I don't think there's a right or wrong answer, because I think everybody needs to make the right decision for themselves. Like, I've taken work for no pay because I think it's worthwhile to me. Like, right. The opportunity, but that's a payment, is worthwhile to me.
Right? That's a payment, right, to you.
Exactly.
So everything, personally, everything that I look at, I'm like, is this something that is fun and I'm willing to do this for little to no money? Or there's some kind of benefit for it? Or is this like a corporate gig that I've, of course, pay me $300 to do that? Like, I think it's absolutely okay as an artist to be like, to have a sliding scale. And also to look at each, and also as like a person who funds or buys things, to look at things and be like, you know what, I'm not going to give to Amanda Palmer's Patreon because I don't think she needs it in a way that, you know, this fan artist that I really like needs it, or, you know, and I only have $5 to give. Not saying that she's not worthy and somebody else is worthy more, but it is an ongoing conversation. There is no black and white, right or wrong answer. Tongue twister.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And that's why, like, I also give, like, I would say, like, I give inconsistently because I try to spread out what I can give to certain things, right? Like, I don't, if in 1 month I can only give $5 and I've already been giving $5 to one thing, like, that $5 is going to become, like, five $1 contributions to multiple things. So, I mean, sometimes it is like, wow, this person really put so much effort into the content that I've been consuming from them that they deserve all five of my dollars, even if that's all I can give them or give anyone. But I think like the conversation around it is so interesting and so deeply personal to people that like, that's why I always try and well, obviously you're the first person that it's been relevant to, but I want to ask more people about this because I think it's a unique and new-ish way to compensate people for the work that they're creating, because it is a new-ish, I'm using air quotes that no one can see, concept to just be giving your art away for free. And is that fair? And how can we balance the scales,
I guess? Yeah, absolutely. It is a very interesting and ongoing conversation. Again, for me, I think the idea that like we still, specifically for the podcast, we still put out a free product and we give you a choice to support us if you want to. Like, that is important to keep the product free. Like, we're not putting that behind a paywall. But like for like the burlesque shows, like to go to a Plan 9 show, it's $20 to go see the show because I have to pay 12 people to put on, you know, I have to pay rent at the theater and I have to pay them for their performance. So like, yeah, you have to pay $20 to come see the show, but it's going to be a really good show and it's going to be worth $20. Come to my shows.
Plan 9, right?
Yep. Plan 9 burlesque. Told you, nerdy stripper.
I mean, I kind of feel like that's the right place to end the podcast. So
full circle.
Thank you for talking to me about all of these things, about what you do for a living, may want to do for a living, have done for a living, all of those kinds of things.
Just figuring out day by day.
Yeah, one step at a time.
Thanks for having me on the podcast. It was so nice to talk to you. I haven't heard your voice in a long time, and it's still as lovely as ever.
Oh, thank you. That's so sweet. That was a lot of fun. Stella's very funny. She cracks me up. I really enjoyed this conversation. It wasn't just fun or funny, but it was really motivating for me. And also, it kind of helped me with some of my own self-reflection. And I hope that everyone who's listening got something out of it too. If you want to talk about this episode, Stella shared her socials in the episode, but you can also message me. You can get at me on Twitter @TheLadyJSays. You can send me a DM on Instagram @TheLadyJSlays, or you can email me theladyjsays@gmail.com. Make sure you tune in next week. I'm not going to tell you who's going to be on the podcast. podcast, you just have to come back, see what we're talking about, see where the next person, the next set of interviews are going. Make sure you're back here next week. I will definitely be here. Gizmo will be here. You never know who will be joining us. Bye.